Hey everyone, I'm Dan Kortler, the host of TED Climate. Each episode, we unpack the problems and solutions of climate change. This season of the show, we're getting into some big ideas that make us optimistic about the future, like meat grown from cells and leather made from mushrooms. And the best part? We look at how building a greener future can be an upgrade instead of a sacrifice. Find and follow TED Climate wherever you're listening to this.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Bob McDonald. Welcome to Quirks and Quarks. On this week's show, anger management. Do you like to let it all out when something gets under your skin? Well, that may not be the healthiest way to deal with rage.
The thing with anger or expressing anger is that it feels good in the moment because you're getting release. But in the long run, it actually increases aggressive behavior.
And conspiracy theorists get a reality check from a surprising source, artificial intelligence.
You can imagine a world where people have AI bots almost as a way to maintain their knowledge-based hygiene, where if you're not sure of a claim, go to an AI that you trust and check your facts.
Plus, wildfires are metal, and that's not a good thing. Physicists agitate for a more modest collider, and an indigenous scientist proposes medicine for our planet. All this today on Quirks and Quarks. For nearly a century, physicists have been smashing subatomic particles together in ever larger, ever more expensive particle accelerators. It's culminated in the famous Large Hadron Collider, which cost billions of dollars, took many years to plan, and a decade to build. It's also huge, located in a circular tunnel 27 kilometers long. But to probe the next level of the subatomic world, scientists will need to spend even more money to make an even larger device, which will take decades to build. So, physicists like Tova Holmes are pushing for a different kind of collider, one she hopes will actually be built within her lifetime. Dr. Holmes is an assistant professor working with experimental high-energy particle physics at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. Hello, and welcome to Quirks and Quarks.
Thank you so much for having me.
First of all, tell me about the current proposal by the physics community for the successor to the Large Hadron Collider.
The current proposal that's coming out of CERN, so this is the lab that's hosting the Large Hadron Collider currently, is to essentially move on to the next stage in our energy frontier exploration by building an even larger proton-proton collider. Right now, the current LHC is sitting sort of between Lake Geneva and the Jura Mountains, which are all just outside of Geneva. And the proposal now is to expand to the whole valley, to basically fill up all that space between the two mountain ranges that hem in Geneva and build a ring that is about as big as you can get there so that we can essentially go to an order of magnitude higher energies than we've ever done before.
It's just astounding that in order to look at smaller and smaller particles, you need larger and larger machines.
That's right. Yes.
Now, what's your problem with that idea?
I'll say I think it's a great idea and I would love for it to happen. However, I don't think it's a great idea if it's the only thing we do. It's really challenging to sustain a community and be able to have constant forward progress and to be able to retain expertise if you don't have multiple sites that are kind of leapfrogging one another, where you can say, okay, we did an interesting project over here at CERN. Now let's go to this other site where we can move the global community to be focused on this while we ramp up for the next thing over there. And the challenge with the even larger energy frontier exploration that's proposed at CERN is, according to the current plans, that machine, amazing as it may be, can't really be built until 2080, which is a really long time from now.
I think that you wrote that you'd like to see a new collider ready before you're dead.
I have been known to say that. Yes, yes.
Okay, so what are you suggesting as an alternative to the extra large Hadron Collider?
Yes. So what I'm proposing and what a lot of us are proposing in the particle physics community is to use muons instead of protons. And so muons are essentially a heavier cousin to the electron. They evade some of the challenges that we have with going to higher energy with the particles we've used in colliders so far. What we basically need to make a collider is we need charged particles that we can get from somewhere and that we can steer around with electric and magnetic fields in order to put them in a collider ring, accelerate them, smash them into each other. And you know, it's convenient if those particles are stable. And that's why we picked our stable charged particles that we have lying around, the electrons and the protons. But they each come with their own challenges in terms of getting to that next energy where we really want to do exploration. So the protons are composite. And so even though you can accelerate them really well and get them to high energies like we do at the LHC, what you're really doing is colliding the constituent particles inside of them, the quarks that are inside of them, and you lose a whole lot of the actual energy because the quarks only carry a tiny fraction of the energy of the total proton. So even though you have a really high energy beam, you're not going to get those high energy collisions. And electrons are fundamental, so you don't have that problem at all. But because of essentially the fact that when you have a charged particle and you accelerate it, it radiates energy. This happens more and more if you have lighter and lighter particles. And the electrons are very light. So basically, if you try to stick in an accelerator, they radiate all the energy you can throw at them as you get to higher and higher energies. And so you just hit a limit. You can't go to the high energies with electron machines. So the muon basically dodges that constraint by being more massive.
Okay, so let me see if I got this right. You're saying protons are big and they're made up of other things like quarks. So you're throwing a complicated thing that you're smashing apart. Electrons are tiny, but they radiate when you try to whip them around. The muon's in the middle. It's sort of in that Goldilocks zone, just right. It's fundamental.
It's fundamental, so you don't lose that energy to having to actually collide the stuff inside of it. And it's massive enough that it doesn't radiate a lot of energy when you accelerate it.
Okay, so if the muon is such an ideal particle, what would a muon accelerator look like?
Yeah, so let me say it is quite ideal in the ways that I talked about, but it's really not ideal in one key way, which is that it decays. So we've used stable particles for our colliders in the past, and that gives us all the time in the world to kind of accelerate them, control them, focus them, and get them into our really nice collisions. The muon, meanwhile, decays in 2 millionths of a second, which is, you know, fast. So they're really not ideal in that way. But basically, that's not a fundamental limitation. That's, let's see if we can make this work for us, right? And you actually, in that case, have special relativity on your side, which is kind of cool. The faster we get that muon going, just like when in a science fiction movie, you shoot some person into space so they age more slowly, that muon is going to decay more slowly if you move it fast. So if you can get it accelerated, it'll stick around longer.
Oh, like maybe 3 or 4 millionths of a second instead of...
Yeah, it's like milliseconds, you know, easy.
Yeah, really. Sounds like you're trying to smash soap bubbles together here.
Yeah.
So how much smaller or easier to build, once you figure out that problem, would a muon collider be?
So if we wanted to go to, let's say, about 10 times the energy reach that we currently have, to do that with a proton-proton collider like the one planned at CERN, we need around 100-kilometer tunnel, maybe a little less. To do it at a muon collider, assuming the same magnet technology, we can do that in a 10-kilometer tunnel. So that's a third the size of the existing LHC.
And what about, you know, expensive to build?
One of the things that drives costs in these machines is the length of tunnel that you have to put these incredible magnets that we're developing into. So if you can shrink the tunnel by a factor of 10, you're not going to shrink the project cost by a factor of 10, but you're going to put a really good dent in this, in the cost of that project.
And more importantly, would it be ready before 2080?
We've had some independent experts look at timescales for these things, and their best guess was that we could have, if we put all of the resources that we needed into this today, we could have one in 2045, which is a lot sooner than 2080, especially if you're a human who lives for a human number of years.
Right. So if this all happens, how could that help with the work that you want to do in physics?
So one thing that it will let us do is take some of the simplest models of dark matter and actually be able to explore them at a collider. So that's one major thing we want to see. And we, of course, know dark matter is out there. So this isn't just grasping at straws, right? It may or may not match these models we're coming out with, but this is a really clear target for us to investigate. And another thing we can do is understand the Higgs boson better. Right now, we found the Higgs boson, which is incredible. And we've been able to measure some of its couplings, other particles, and show that it sort of behaves like we expected it to. But when we try to understand the why of the Higgs boson, so why does this thing happen that's unlike any other particle we know that somehow gives mass to all the particles, and why do the masses look like that, and how do we even explain the mass of the Higgs itself? All of these are really unknown, and the only way to really get at the core of those questions is by going to high energies and producing a whole bunch of Higgs bosons and watching them interact with each other. So we basically need to go make high energy Higgs bosons, and then we'll understand a whole lot more about how the universe came to be as it is.
Well, Dr. Holmes, let's hope this project comes through before you die. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Dr. Tova Holmes is an assistant professor at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. Okay, can I just vent for a moment? I really need to blow off some steam. I mean, these producers I work with, the constant demands, the whining, the neediness. I mean, they should be used to me by now. It makes me crazy. All right. In all seriousness, I like my producers. But when we're feeling angry, we're sometimes told to deal with it by just letting the emotion out, by screaming into a pillow, going for a jog, or hitting a punching bag. But a recent study suggests that cooling off is easier if you focus on your breath or count to 10 in your head. Sophie Charvik reviewed 154 studies that examined different ways of managing anger to see which ones are more effective. She's a postdoctoral fellow in the Injury and Violence Prevention Program at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Virginia. Dr. Charvik, welcome to Quirks and Quarks.
Thank you for having me.
Why did you decide to study anger management?
I've seen that there is a surge in what we call rage rooms popping up all over the world. And those are counterintuitive to dealing with anger. They actually might increase your anger. And I wanted to debunk the myth that expressing anger is a good way of dealing with anger.
Now, these rage rooms, how do they work?
You basically pay to go into a room where you are allowed to smash different objects.
Oh, like throw plates on the floor, that kind of thing?
Yes, you could do it with a bat, or you can throw it in the walls or the floor, whatever you would like.
Well, before you took on this review, what did you suspect might be the best way to deal with anger feelings?
Well, because anger is an emotion with high physiological arousal, which means that it gets your blood pumping, it gets your heart rate up, we suspected that techniques to reduce that arousal would be most effective at dealing with anger.
So what techniques did you review in your research?
So we looked at different techniques such as mindfulness, meditation, yoga, and muscle relaxation as ways of reducing arousal. And we looked at several physical activities such as jogging, ball sports. We also looked at swimming and so on.
Okay, so you've got the calm yourself down, sit still technique, or do something physical.
Yes.
What did you find?
We found that activities that decreases arousal, such as mindfulness, meditation, yoga, are good ways of dealing with anger. It will reduce your arousal and it will reduce your anger. But we also found that there was huge differences between physical activities. So some activities actually increase anger, such as jogging, and other activities actually reduced anger, such as ball sports or physical education classes.
Why the difference?
Well, there wasn't specifically any research showing why, because there was no research including both types of activities. But we think that the reason why jogging increases anger is because it's a more monotone and boring activity where you have time to ruminate on your anger, whereas ball sports are introducing the aspect of play. And so you're inducing positive emotions, such as joy. You're also getting positive feedback from your coach, maybe your teammates. And so that's also a social aspect that introduces positive emotions.
Okay. And what about rage rooms?
Well, there wasn't actually any studies on rage rooms, but there were studies on boxing. And we saw that boxing had negative effects.
But it sounds like even if you're doing physical activity, that the mind is an important part of this.
Yes. So we actually found for arousal reducing activities that the cognitive aspect is important too. So for example, mindfulness and meditation were more effective at reducing anger than, for example, muscle relaxation and yoga.
So how much more effective were the mindfulness activities compared to the physical ones?
I would say slightly more effective. And we think that is because when you are doing body relaxation, let's say you're laying on the ground trying to calm down your breathing, you're only focusing on your body. But if you're doing mindfulness, you are not only focusing on calming down your breath and focused on your breath, but you're also focused on letting your thoughts drift away on this cloud or something like that.
Now, venting might bring some relief for anger for some people, though. They may, I really need to hit something. So do your findings suggest they still shouldn't do it, even if it feels good?
Yeah, so the thing with anger or expressing anger is that it feels good in the moment because you're getting release. But research shows that in the long run, it actually increases aggressive behavior, which is obviously undesirable in society.
Yeah, I'm thinking of things like road rage, where we seem to be seeing more and more anger as traffic situations get worse and worse.
Road rage is a common topic when it comes to anger because you're in a stressful situation. You are often blocked from getting to your goal. You're thinking that everyone in front of you are dumb for driving so slow. And you're just screaming at these people in your car to yourself. Nobody can hear you. And that is not so good when it comes to anger. You're actually then practicing aggressive behavior. So what you should do if you're in a situation where you are, let's say, on the verge of becoming aggressive in your car, you should try to focus on deep breathing techniques or letting your emotion drift away on a cloud.
I guess swearing comes into that category of raising your blood pressure.
Most studies focus on the activation of the body, so the physical expression. And there wasn't really enough studies to examine the verbal expression. But the few studies that I did look at were definitely indicating that yelling into a pillow or other forms of expressing anger are not effective either.
So I'm just curious, what technique do you use when something really annoys you?
I try to cool down and step away from the situation and take some time for myself.
Good advice. Dr. Scharvik, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Sophie Scharvik is a postdoctoral fellow in the Injury and Violence Prevention Program at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Virginia. Canada's air quality last year got a failing grade in a new report from the tech company IQ Air, largely due to our worst fire season on record.
Previous years, Canada has the cleanest air quality in all of North America, and this year we saw the exact opposite.
The report measured levels of PM2.5, a pollutant that can spew out from wildfires, travel deep into lung tissue, and can cause breathing, heart, and cognitive problems.
This PM2.5 particulate matter is what stings our eyes and throat and can irritate our lungs when we encounter wildfire smoke. And it's bad enough. But now it seems there may be a whole other dimension of toxicity that intense wildfires can unleash when they transform a certain naturally occurring metal in soils and rocks. Dr. Scott Fendorf led this work. He's a professor of Earth System Science at Stanford University in California. Hello and welcome to Quirks and Quarks.
Hi, Bob. Thanks for having me.
What first tipped you off that wildfires might be able to release a toxic form of metal?
We had been studying heavy metals in soils for quite some time, and there was a study that came out from an Australian group in 2019 that looked at chromium minerals and how, if you heated them, you could transfer the fairly benign form of chromium that we call trivalent chromium or chromium-3 into the really toxic form, which we call hexavalent or chromium-6. It's a class 1 carcinogen. And what's particularly bad is that we often think about it from consumption through drinking water. Inhalation, though, and getting into the lung tissue is particularly bad from the toxicology standpoint.
Okay, so that was from Australia. How did you decide to investigate this further?
Right. So the Australian group looked that if you took these soil minerals and heated them, that it would change the chromium form from the benign to the toxic form. And we had been studying that same process, but not through heating, through and looking at it in soils. But the heating experiments were obviously an indication towards wildfire. And that same year, we had a big set of wildfires here in the San Francisco Bay Area. And it triggered the idea that we should start looking for that toxin in the soils in those fire zones. And so I pulled out the geologic maps, I pulled out the fire maps and started overlaying those to see if we had high chromium geology, which leads to high chromium soils and plants in the regions that were being burned. And we had this really nice tapestry where we had high chromium rocks juxtaposed to low chromium rocks where the fire had gone across. And so one of my students went up then to start sampling and came back, measured the levels of chromium 6 in the soils. We did a matrix that had high chromium soils, low chromium soils that had been burned, and then high chromium soils and low chromium soils that had not been burned. And what we found is when the fires had come across these soils, particularly with the high chromium, sure enough, we saw high levels of hexavalent chromium being produced.
Wow. So it's the heat of the wildfires that's transforming the chromium into this toxic form.
The heat is a catalyst, really. It's a reaction of the chromium with the oxygen in the air. But that reaction is really slow at normal temperatures. But when we heat it up above about 400 degrees Celsius, then we see that reaction start going quite rapidly. And that leads from chromium 3 then to the chromium 6 that I was mentioning.
So how does the intensity of the fire affect how much of this chromium gets transformed?
The factors that affect the transformation are first the intensity of the fire. So the more intense the fire, up to a point at least, the more hexavalent chromium you have produced. The other parts are the geology that I mentioned already. So rocks with higher chromium are going to lead to more chromium being transformed through that same reaction. And then because of the fire intensity, you have the two factors that control that are going to be what the moisture levels are and what the type of plants are, the canopy, if you will. And so we see, for example, grasslands lead to low intensity. We don't get as much chromium 6 being produced. If we have a very dense shrubs or forested area, then we see a higher degree of transfer because of the greater intensity of the fire.
So where does this toxic form of chromium end up after the fire?
Yeah. So we were doing, if you will, hindcasting. We had the fires come through. And then right after that, we came in and did sampling within about a week to look at what the particulate matter was that was left behind from the fires. With that said, what we also recognize, though, is that you started off with talking about PM2.5, so these very small particles. We see an abundance of this hexavalent chromium actually in that small particulate matter. Because those particles are easily windborne, we can also surmise that those particles will also be part of the smoke and dust that is generated during the wildfire itself. So then those are moving downwind, and some subsequent studies that we haven't published yet are showing that it can move in the range of 1,000 miles, so you think about 1,500 kilometers plus of movement. So these particles can move long distances.
Wow. What about that remains in the soil? What are the implications there for things like drinking water, for example?
Yeah. It's a high concentration of this very toxic material in a very thin veneer in the soil. So when we start to think about groundwater as that thin veneer, it's quantitatively actually a small amount of chromium if you were really thinking about the distance from the surface all the way down to the groundwater. So it gets diluted. So we don't see a big signature of it moving into groundwater. For surface waters, right after a fire, if you have a very strong rainstorm, you could get surficial movement into small rivers and so on where you might pick it up and it could be problematic for short periods of time. But what we quickly recognized is that the major exposure was that thin veneer with high concentration is exactly what you're stirring up in terms of dust, whether it be a wind that's coming in after the fire or if you have fire responders that are coming in to do what we call mop up, right, doing the last stage of the fire or later on revegetation, or if you open it up back to a community and have people walking through, those are really the major exposure pathways, and it's through inhalation and creating the dust that you then get exposed to.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any sense of whether the fires we saw here in Canada in 2023 were over chromium-rich soils?
We do, and yes, they were.
Oh, do you know what areas?
If you think about these large wildfires we had in the eastern central part, from our perspective in the U.S., we saw that smoke moving down the eastern seaboard. All that came from smoke that was derived over high chromium rocks.
Wow. What does this mean then about how much more concerned we should be about inhaling wildfire smoke, which we already knew was bad for our health?
Think about PM2.5. We think about it as a physical irritant that then can cause medical problems, but we're seeing that somewhat blind to the chemistry of the particles themselves. And there's a host of toxic chemicals that can be in the particles that we really haven't had the fidelity to go in and say that these particles are going to be much worse than those particles. And that's in the stage of the fire science that we need to move into so that we can have much greater acknowledgement of what the risk factor is from the particles we're being exposed to. And I'll just say really quickly, when we had the large wildfires here in the Bay Area in 2019 and 2020, it was in the early stages of our work, and I was pretty cavalier to the PM2.5 warnings, but it completely changed my risk assessment once we had our results back, that now when I even see moderate warnings, if I know that those wildfires are coming from high chromium areas, I would be very careful about getting exposure and making sure I'm wearing an N95 mask.
Dr. Fendorf, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Scott Fendorf is a professor of Earth System Science at Stanford University in California.
Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements?
I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Bob McDonald, and you're listening to Quirks and Quarks on CBC Radio 1. Coming up later in the program, an indigenous scientist on some of the medicine our planet needs.
We're sort of on an environmental apology tour. You know, we've done so much wrong that has harmed our planet that we then kind of have swung so far the other way that we've kind of lost the forest for the trees.
Conspiracy theories, often driven by hostile governments, political bad actors, or just troublemakers, are a blight on modern life. Modern social media has fed oxygen to these corrosive and bizarre ideas, often to the cost of our civil discourse. Last year, a poll came out suggesting that as many as 79% of Canadians believe in at least one conspiracy theory. But fear not. Soon, we may be able to rely on artificial intelligence to take on the tough task of debunking these unfounded notions. A team has recruited OpenAI's latest chatbot, the GPT-4 Turbo, to the task. Scientists paired people with conspiratorial beliefs up with the chatbot to see if it could pull those who might have fallen too far down the misinformation rabbit hole back out. Early signs are that the chatbot can be a lot more convincing than another human. Dr. Thomas Costello is the lead author of this project, which we should say has not yet been peer-reviewed. He's a research psychologist and postdoctoral fellow at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Cambridge. Hello, Dr. Costello. Welcome to our program.
Thanks so much. I'm thrilled to be here.
So what made you think that chatbots might be able to succeed in debunking conspiracy theories in a way that, well, humans have just not had much luck with?
Yeah, so sort of famously, conspiracy theorists are pretty hard to reason with. They don't change their mind very easily, or at least that was the common wisdom in my field of psychology. Our thinking in bringing in generative artificial intelligence was that conspiracy theorists are really heterogeneous, and the sorts of beliefs that people have differ quite a bit. By contrast, these artificial intelligence entities, programs, are trained on this vast corpus of data, the entire internet. And so they're able to very fluently mount arguments that are targeted to each individual conspiracy theorist's belief.
Now, how reliable are these chatbots in knowing the difference between actual facts and conspiracies themselves?
That's a great question. It's one we're looking into now. We have all of these conversations between conspiracy believers and AI. So we're having professional fact checkers go through. And the AI did seem to do a pretty good job, although those results are still in process. Of course, that there's going to be some unreliability. And I know that the large frontier AI companies, like OpenAI, for example, are working hard to put guardrails on the models. But these hallucinations, as they're sometimes called, which is to say false statements that the models make, do sometimes occur. For our purposes, we weren't so worried about that. We were more interested in whether the AI models could persuade people at all.
Okay, but they're not 100% reliable.
No, definitely not.
All right. So how then did you test the way these chatbots worked in debunking conspiracy theories? Take me through the experiment.
So what we did was we recruited a bunch of participants. All in all, it was several thousand people. And we started the experiment by asking in an open-ended way, are there any conspiracy theories that you find credible and that you believe, in so many words? And we allowed people to say yes, no, whatever they really wanted. And they then named the conspiracy theory that they favored. They wrote it down. They said, maybe the 9/11 terrorist attacks were orchestrated by the government. We then followed up and asked them why they thought that, and again, in an open-ended way. So they wrote down the evidence that they thought supported their conspiracy belief. Once we had all of that, we fed it into GPT-4, the artificial intelligence model. Once we did that, we then allowed participants to enter into a back-and-forth conversation with GPT-4. However, we provided, we kind of armed the AI with all of the previous text that the participant had supplied, how much they believe the conspiracy, what it was, that sort of thing, and instructed the AI model to try to persuade people against their favored conspiracy belief.
And how well did the chatbot work in debunking the conspiracy beliefs?
We were surprised by how well it worked. It ended up reducing conspiracy beliefs on average by about 20%. So that is a much larger effect than you tend to see in the human-based interventions, at least those that have been published and that are available in the literature.
So what was the chatbot doing that the humans can't? What made it so successful?
Yeah, there are a few possibilities. One is that it's able to pull from all of these different pieces of evidence in a way that's cohesive and coherent, and it can be done in real time. It may also be that because there wasn't a human on the other end, they didn't feel judged, or perhaps they implicitly or explicitly really trusted the capabilities of this AI model. That's another possibility. It could be all things together in this like emergent sort of system of persuasion. Mm-hmm. The AI model also frequently expressed like empathy and understanding and validated people's feelings. So to draw from this one conversation with 9/11, it opened by saying, thank you for sharing your thoughts and concerns about the 9/11 attacks. It's completely understandable given the complexity and magnitude of the events that day, why questions and doubts such as those you've mentioned might arise. So I think some confluence of this all.
So how well might this kind of exercise work to shift the overall conspiracy mindset?
Yeah, good question. I don't know. One thing we did find, though, is that in our participants, the intervention's efficacy spilled over to other kinds of conspiracy theories. So although they were talking with the AI about only one sort of conspiracy, we also asked them about their belief in a host of others after they went through the conversation. And participants in the treatment condition, compared to our control, actually decreased their beliefs in unrelated conspiracies. So what? Those that weren't talked about in the conversation. So this is at least some preliminary evidence that these conversations may decrease the overall conspiratorial worldview.
And was this a lasting effect?
It sure was. The people in the treatment condition who went down by about 20% stayed that way. 10 days later, they were just as skeptical as they were immediately after the conversation. And that was also true 2 months later. So this was remarkably durable.
So what kind of impact do you think this technology of using chatbots to, well, convince people to change their thinking would help to improve civil discourse in our society in general?
Yeah, I think what this study provides is a window into how we might go about changing people's mind. The question of how scalable it is, I think, is still an unresolved one. But it's promising, right? You can imagine a world where people have AI bots almost as a way to maintain their knowledge-based hygiene, where if you're not sure of a claim, you can go to an AI that you trust and check your facts.
So just one last thing, Dr. Costello, we've been having a very nice conversation here. How do I know that you're not a chatbot?
I think you'll just have to trust me on that one.
Hate to tell you, but I'm the chatbot.
Oh, no. Well, you're a very charming chatbot with a great voice. So,
Dr. Costello, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Dr. Thomas Costello is a research psychologist and postdoctoral fellow at MIT. This week marks Earth Day, a time to take stock in how we treat our planet and celebrate conservation and environmental sustainability. Of course, for some people, every day is Earth Day, like Indigenous ecologist Dr. Jennifer Grenz. She has spent decades working to protect ecosystems in the Pacific Northwest through restoration and invasive species management. But recently, frustrated by the limitations of her work, Dr. Grenz set out on a mission to incorporate more of her indigenous worldview into her traditional Western science work. And along the way, she found that this process of, as she calls it, combining her head and her heart, not only helps her be a better scientist, but to also be a better protector of our planet. She wrote about this journey in a new book called Medicine Wheel for the Planet, A Journey Toward Personal and Ecological Healing. Dr. Grenz is an Indigenous scholar and assistant professor and principal investigator of the Indigenous Ecology Lab at the Faculty of Forestry at the University of British Columbia. Hello and welcome back to Quirks and Quarks.
Ahchwin, Bob. Hello, Cooks Gem, for having me.
What set you down this path of changing how you approach your science?
I think it was a lot of ecological angst in myself, someone who had spent almost two decades, you know, trying to bring healing to lands and waters and really just not making the difference I felt like we really need to.
So what did you see as limitations to the Western approach to science?
I think that it really was too formulaic. We approached different lands with, you know, sort of a cookie cutter. And so everywhere that we went, we essentially did the same thing in terms of ecological restoration. So we would get to a place, we'd look around, we'd identify, you know, which plants didn't belong, which invasive species were there. We would do what needed to be done to attempt to eradicate them. And then we would plant native plants in their place, only to come back, you know, soon after to find that the weeds were either back or there were new invasive species there, and that the native species that we planted in their place, you know, didn't make it. And it was just repeat, repeat, repeat.
So you're saying the Western science was a little too narrowly focused?
It was absolutely narrowly focused. It really was leaning on this idea of belongingness and that all lands are the same. And that really isn't the case at all. And so I really felt motivated to go a little deeper and try and understand, you know, why we weren't making the difference that we needed to. You know, why were plants that we, you know, put in the ground not making it, even when we watered them and fertilized them? You know, why were the weeds actually coming back, you know, even though we had done, great work trying to get rid of them?
How much of a challenge was it for you to join your Western scientist side to your Indigenous side?
I wish I could say that it was easy, but it was actually very difficult. I think when we're trained in anything, you know, and for me, my education was rooted in Western science, which is a wonderful thing and still continues to serve me well. However, it really limited my thinking and how I approached land. But to unravel that and, you know, learn to see things anew and think differently really challenged me, because it felt like I was breaking every scientific rule I had ever been taught in terms of just, you know, spending time on land, our methodologies, you know, our ways of asking questions of, you know, what was data had suddenly changed as well. You know, it wasn't just things that we could measure, but, you know, listening to stories, learning the true histories of land, and then how to integrate that. So I wish I could say it was a quick and easy journey. I certainly was willing and wanted to have it happen, but it really took a number of years to be able to effectively do that.
Well, how are these two ways of thinking at odds with each other?
I think, you know, how they end up at odds with each other is just in those methodologies, in how we ask research questions, in what we consider data to be, and how we do that analysis. You know, an example would be when I would go out and do, you know, vegetation surveys and look at land and map where invasive species were. It was, you know, on a grid, and we had similar methodology anywhere we went, you know, identify the plants, measure them, understand, you know, their abundance. And then, you know, when I went into more indigenous research methodologies, I was told to throw my notebook away. In fact, an elder knocked it out of my hands and told me just to sit and just be on the land and watch and observe. And I think what was really different for me was suddenly I was seeing relationships that I hadn't noticed before. You know, when you take a formulaic approach to something, you kind of stop seeing what's around you. You know, you don't really listen, you don't smell. And as a plant person, you know, I was only looking at the plants. But suddenly, you know, when our methodology meant we were just sitting and observing and getting to know somewhere, you know, suddenly you're noticing what insects might be munching on some of those same plants you're trying to manage, or that the soils are actually looking a little bit different in one spot versus another.
Give me more of a sense of that indigenous perspective and how you braid these two together to do science.
Well, I have a story I can share that will, you know, help us mm-hmm. to understand that better. You know, as someone who's managed invasive species for a really long time, when we would eradicate a species, think it was gone, sort of high five ourselves and celebrate, you know, it would come back, or another one would come back in its place. And it really felt a lot like we were chasing our tails. And then I was talking to an elder from a nation whose land I was working on and expressed my frustration. You know, why can we just not get rid of these things? And, you know, why do our native species or our plant relations not establish afterwards? And he said to me, well, you know, Jen, maybe they're changing the stories of the soil. You know, maybe these invasive species, they're changing the story of the soil. And I left that day and just ruminated on that for days, you know, thinking like, what does that mean? And then I started thinking a little bit about soil microbial ecology, you know, an area of expertise I did not have at the time. And, you know, we started to investigate. And sure enough, we found that there are a number of invasive species that actually change the soil microbes, the bacterial and fungal populations, such that the relations, the fungal relations in particular, that a number of our native species need are no longer there for them. And so this is something that now we are investigating, you know, more fully in our lab. And it was all because of that openness, you know, to thinking about things in a different way.
You also mentioned in your book that there's no such thing as a good plant or a bad plant.
Yeah, you know, we really have gotten into this almost xenophobic approach to understanding, you know, the plant relations around us. And in my PhD research, I actually was asking elders of different nations, you know, what are indigenous perspectives on invasive species? And, you know, it was a lot less polarized than I had experienced asking that question within, you know, Western scientific contexts, or even just, you know, other people, right? Where it's like either kill everything that doesn't belong or live and let live. And instead, the answers were kind of in the middle of that spectrum, and it really depended on what the context was. And so I think that there's a lot to be learned from that, that we have this tendency to want to hit pause on our ecosystems, but we live on a dynamic and changing planet, and even more so because of climate change. And so maybe we need to have that same epistemic openness, you know, to how we think about other species. And one great example is, you know, under today's evaluation of whether a plant is invasive or not, 5,000 years ago, Western red cedar, our keystone species, you know, in the Pacific Northwest, would have been considered invasive. So I think we just need to have that openness and spend that time to understand, you know, what kind of impacts these newcomers are actually having.
You frame your book around a medicine wheel. Take me through what the four directions of the wheel signify.
I chose the medicine wheel because as I was having my own challenges, you know, bringing my head Western science and heart Indigenous worldview together, I went through, you know, a range of teachings that all had to happen in the right order for me to be open to trying this out. And, you know, the medicine wheel isn't this linear journey where we like, you know, we start at the beginning and we accomplish it and we, you know, and then we're done. It's meant to be repeated over and over. And so it reminds me a lot of, you know, the scientific method as well, right? We're always questioning, evaluating, and, you know, starting that cycle over again. So for the medicine wheel, we start in the northern direction, which is the direction of our ancestors and our elders, where we're drawing on wisdom, you know, that knowledge as well as those stories that can help us have the context that we often don't have. And then moving into the eastern direction, you know, that is where we really have to spend time unlearning, you know, challenging ourselves to not end up in this sort of like automatic way of seeing or observing that, you know, we get used to within any profession that we do, right? And then from that, moving into the time of the South is when you're ready for this time of rapid transformation, for planting new seeds, for trying something new. But, you know, you needed that openness to be able to do that. And then finally ending up in the West, you know, this is where we reap what we sow. You know, we get to really see, you know, how we benefited from trying something new and then to spend that time evaluating and reflecting on that before we cycle through again.
So putting that all together, how would you explain Indigenous research methodology?
I think I would explain Indigenous research methodology as it is rooted in reciprocity and respect and relationality, the three R's as we call them. So, you know, when we're approaching research, you know, we're working respectfully on the lands and that we're working in reciprocity. You know, we're always asking the question, what are we giving back when we're doing this work? You know, and then how are we working relationally? Are we really understanding all the relationships around us? You know, ecology is so complex and we think we study relationships, but within Indigenous research methodology, you really realize your own limitations as a scientist, you know, and I would never, ever now go into the forest alone to study something. You know, I need a soil scientist with me. I need an archaeologist with me. And then also what we consider data is different. It's, you know, there aren't any hard and fast rules. You know, we can learn from our children. We can learn from people who frequent areas all the time. I write in my book about, you know, how the dog walkers of areas where they've been walking, you know, two different generations of their own dogs through a place. They have information, you know, that's useful, that can help us understand what's happening around us. But that said, you know, then I find what happens is it generates different kinds of questions where then we can bring in those Western scientific tools to help us answer those questions. Because as a really good friend of mine, Jared Williams, Kwistanekin from Cowichan Tribe said to me, you know, what you're doing, Jen, is bringing together the tools of the old and new ancestors. And I really think that's what Indigenous research methodology is all about.
Now, you talk about the importance of storytelling, how stories are data, but sometimes that can be difficult to accept. Oh, those are just stories. Why do you think they're so important?
You know, stories really are data because they inform, you know, what we see around us or how we understand the world around us. And without that context, you know, how can we possibly do good science? As an example, you know, stories were shared with me about the use of cultural burning, that there are entire areas in whole mountains, in fact, like Thompson Mountain by the Fraser River, had no trees on it because that mountain was used for harvesting berries. And so you can't grow berries if there's a ton of trees, you know, very closely together, right? You need that open habitat. And I work a lot on wildfire recovery with other nations. And that story really changed for me how I thought about, you know, how do we fix these systems after these catastrophic climate events like mega wildfire? I realized on the edge of the fire that I was working on, which was the McKay Creek fire, I looked out over the landscape. And what would have been beautiful and amazing to me, and right in the brand of supernatural British Columbia, was just solid interior Douglas fir all the way across the landscape. Like this monotypic stand, you know, tight together interior Douglas fir and nothing else. But it looked to me, before I knew that story, beautiful and normal. You know, like this was the baseline. This is what got ruined by this fire. This is what was destroyed. But when that elder shared that story with me and started telling me more about cultural burning and how, you know, a lot of areas, both sides of the Fraser River, didn't have a single tree on them, I realized that this baseline, you know, this admiration for trees was so wrong. That our purposeful shaping of ecosystems is what brings biodiversity. So, you know, without that data, without that story, we would have just been focused on putting all those trees back because that's what we thought was normal.
Mm-hmm. You have some harsh words for the current environmental movement. How would you like to see a change?
Well, I'm not totally harsh. I have a lot of respect for, you know, people that are out doing their best trying to change the planet, and that we have a world where so many people care about it. So let me start with that. However, I feel like the modern environmental movement has gotten things a little bit wrong, you know, and we need to reevaluate, you know, what environmentalism means to us. As an example, you know, we really value trees. We've been taught that, you know, now from the time I was a kid in elementary school, right? The tree kind of became the symbol of environmentalism. However, we need to think a little bit deeper about what these systems were and what we need them to be. We have this very kind of aesthetic relationship, you know, with the environment, but is that really serving us? Because now we're losing biodiversity. And another example of that that I talk about in my book is Gary Oak Meadows, you know, which are very important ecosystems, and there are less than 5% of them left in the Pacific Northwest that have many rare species and at-risk species in them. But they exist because of fire stewardship. Because of Indigenous fire stewardship, keeping canopies open and stopping coniferous trees from moving in. And we can't use fire stewardship in a lot of places now because neighborhoods were, you know, built all around them on Vancouver Island. So understandably, people don't want us to light fires. But now we have this closing canopy and we're losing Gary Oak Meadow because the coniferous trees are marching inwards. And so there was a case in an area where I was helping to do some management and do research where we couldn't use fire. So we were going to cut the trees down to open the canopy back up and save the Gary Oaks that were sort of almost like being smothered. And there was an uproar in the neighborhood that we couldn't cut a single tree down. You know, so this is what I mean about, you know, my criticisms of the modern environmental movement is like, yes, trees are important, but which trees? And in what places, you know? So we need to think a little bit deeper about these relationships and what our goals are. And maybe I think it comes from a place where we're sort of on an environmental apology tour. You know, we've done so much wrong that has harmed our planet that we then kind of have swung so far the other way that we've kind of lost the forest for the trees, right? Like it's, you know, so it's just, we have to make sure that we're really thinking deeply about what our goals are, and that it's okay for us to shape ecosystems respectfully and relationally.
Dr. Grenz, thank you so much for your time and happy Earth Day.
Happy Earth Day to you. Thank you so much. Cook's Gem.
Dr. Jennifer Grenz is an Indigenous scholar and assistant professor and principal investigator of the Indigenous Ecology Lab at the Faculty of Forestry at the University of British Columbia. And that's it for Quirks and Quarks this week. If you'd like to get in touch with us, our email is quirks@cbc.ca. Or just go to the contact link in our webpage at cbc.ca/quirks, where you can read my latest blog or listen to our audio archives. You can also follow our podcast or get us on the CBC Listen app. It's free from the App Store or Google Play. Quirks and Quarks is produced by Livia Dyring, Olsi Sorokina, Amanda Buckowitz, and Sonia Biting. Our senior producer is Jim Lebbins. I'm Bob McDonald. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.